This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama signs new law on national surveillance. FIFA President Sepp Blatter resigns unexpectedly.
It's clear to me that this resignation would not be made in the absence of something that has significantly occurred since his re-election recently.
China imposes a new smoking policy. A successful boy band singer goes solo. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Obama signed into law a bill ending the government's massive collection of telephone call data intended to prevent terrorist attacks. On Tuesday, acting just hours after Congress approved the measure, Mr. Obama said the new rules protect both civil liberties and national security. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Senate correspondent Michael Bowman about what persuaded the Senate's approval despite some significant opposition.
The 67-32 vote approving the bill by the Senate came about by a realization by many Republicans that it was this bill or nothing. In other words, without some bill, there would be no restarting of the bulk collection of Americans' telephone records. And there were many Republicans who opposed the bill on principle, who felt that these records should be kept by the National Security Agency so that they would have easy access to those records. But faced with the possibility of no records being kept at all by any entity, there were enough Republicans who grudgingly voted for the bill, joining with Democrats who were unified in their support for it, that the bill ultimately passed.
Is there any sense of what pressure these Republican senators who did grudgingly approve the bill, what pressure did they come under to get them to take this step today?
Michael, this was a vote that is somewhat rare on Capitol Hill in that there are an awful lot of votes where it's partisan lockstep, where all Democrats vote one way and all Republicans vote the other way. Today's vote was a vote of pure conscience. Individual senators were voting according to what they felt was ultimately best for the nation. And you could tell from the floor debate that they took it very seriously, and they were really grappling with big concept issues having to do with national security and constitutional guarantees and civil liberties and Americans' right to privacy. And that is really, I would venture to say that down to a single member, senators weren't necessarily responding to specific pressures from their constituents, but rather to the internal battles of their own conscience.
Under the new rules, U.S. telephone companies, and not the super-secret National Security Agency, will collect and hold on to the phone call records of American citizens. Federal investigators would then need a court order to examine those records if they suspect anyone of contacting known or suspected terrorists. Sepp Blatter, president of the World Football Federation, FIFA, abruptly resigned Tuesday in the midst of an unfolding corruption scandal. Blatter had been reelected to a fifth term as president just 4 days earlier. He ordered an extraordinary Congress of the Football Federation to choose a new president and said he will retain his presidential powers until then. The announcement made at a news conference in Zurich came as a surprise since the 79-year-old president had repeatedly professed his innocence throughout days of adverse publicity about FIFA executives' corrupt activities and multimillion-dollar bribe-taking. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Chris Eaton, Executive Director of Sport Integrity at the International Institute for Sport Security in Doha, Qatar, on the unexpected resignation.
Now we have the resignation of Sepp Blatter, the head of FIFA. Mr. Eaton, how significant is it that he just won election to a fifth term this past Friday, and now he's giving it up? What's going on here?
Obviously something has happened that we're not aware of. And it's clear to me that this resignation would not be made in the absence of something that has significantly occurred since his re-election recently. So there's something I'm sure that will come out in the fullness of time about why he's resigned.
One would jump to a conclusion and say, maybe they got the goods on Mr. Blatter this time. There is a Swiss investigation, after all. Is that the sort of thing you're referring to?
Well, of clearly there's two investigations concurrent, at least two, and that's the US investigation and the Swiss investigation. Both have been taking records from FIFA. Both have been examining evidence and hearing from sources. So it's clear that at least those two investigations might have some additional information, additional evidence that has put pressure on the president to resign. But in any case, this will turn up.
In his news conference announcing that he was going to give up his post, he did say FIFA needs a profound restructuring. Interesting to come from him. You made the comment in an earlier interview with me that FIFA is one of the most opaque organizations on the planet. Why don't you expand upon that? What is FIFA needing to do to become a responsible sport organization?
First, it needs to grow up and grow up into the real world of business affairs and transnational, multinational business. It needs to understand the need for transparency, accountability, best practice, know your customer, fit and proper persons tests, all these significant commercial and global commercial standards that a business that FIFA have never applied. They are really a private monopoly, a private club operating a sport monopoly. It's time for them to grow up.
We have heard lots of praise for Mr. Blatter for extending the sport of football throughout the developing world to Africa, etc. Even with these advancements and the expansion of the game, how does it go forward with credibility, with all sides saying, we believe in this organization, we believe in this sport? What does it take to make this unified?
Well, first and foremost, it takes the organization to become predominated by people interested in and loving the sport, the overall sport, not just the peak of the sport, not just the World Cup, not just the top teams and the top players, but the sport itself. And this is an extremely important change, the way in which FIFA operates. I mean, FIFA really is there for the World Cup. It is not there to protect the totality of the sport, and it has not protected the totality of the sport. I want to see a separation between the issue of governance, those people who love the sport, and the marketing and business of the sport. There's nothing wrong with a successful business, but it must be offset with a very successful governance approach.
Chris Eaton is Executive Director for Sport Integrity at the International Institute for Sport Security in Doha, Qatar. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
Election of a new FIFA president apparently will take months. Experts expect a vote could occur between December of this year and March of 2016. The FIFA corruption scandal erupted last week when Swiss police raided a meeting of the federation's top leaders in Switzerland. Charges of receiving bribes and racketeering were brought against several suspects from South America, the United States, and elsewhere, amid swirling allegations of millions of dollars in bribes paid to influence the staging of international soccer tournaments, including the World Cup. Social media is chattering about the surprise FIFA resignation. Here again is Michael Libin with details on reaction.
Thanks, Ray. Sepp Blatter's impending resignation as FIFA president made a big impact on the Twitter world today. Analytics website Topsy says Blatter's name has been tweeted at least 950,000 times in the past 24 hours. That's an average of 11 tweets per second. That figure also exceeds the 600,000 times his name was tweeted last Friday when he was re-elected as FIFA president by the organization's members. Major news outlets pounced on the story today. The New York Times tweeted, U.S. officials confirmed that Sepp Blatter was a focus of a federal corruption investigation. Here's another tweet from British newspaper The Guardian. Sepp Blatter finally lets go of FIFA as FBI noose tightens, the FBI being the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation. News magazine The Economist put out this tweet. So it turns out that Sepp Blatter's shamelessness does have its limits after all. And from Time magazine, this quote from its latest story. Since he took over as FIFA president in 1998, corruption has tainted Blatter's reign. Former England national team soccer player Rio Ferdinand also weighed in on Blatter's resignation. Using his Twitter handle at Rio35, Ferdinand said, Blatter should have been an elder statesman and moved to one side to let the next generation influence the game from the top. Ray, back to you.
Thanks, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lipin. That's L-I-P-I-N. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Innocent civilians in Yemen pay the highest price.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition from Washington. The coalition of countries fighting the Islamic State group have backed an Iraqi plan to retake Anbar province and its capital Ramadi, which fell to the extremists last month. Baghdad demanded more support from its allies in a meeting in Paris Tuesday, as Lisa Bryant reports.
Baghdad's plan aims to get more recruits for the Iraqi army and more tribal fighters mobilized and armed. It was presented Tuesday by Iraqi Prime Minister Haidar al-Abadi at a Paris meeting. Following the talks, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it is the right plan militarily and politically.
In Iraq, right now, we have the right strategy. A combination of coalition airstrikes, training, equipping, assisting, and effective local partners. That is the winning strategy, but only if both sides of the equation are present. What we heard today is that Prime Minister Abadi's side of the equation is present and adjusting to the challenges that we're seeing in places like Anbar.
Coalition partners will also start shipping anti-tank rockets to Iraq for use against suicide vehicles operated by the Islamic State group, which is also known as Daesh.
The first tranche of these rockets will arrive as early as this week, and we're also continuing, of course, our air missions in Anbar and elsewhere to keep the pressure on Daesh.
The Paris meeting gathered the diplomats from the U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State. Secretary of State John Kerry was not there because of a broken leg. U.S. officials have criticized Iraqi forces for not fighting harder at Ramadi, and coalition members want Iraq to be more inclusive of Sunni fighters.
We're asking for more support for the Iraqi military. I'd like to mention
Prime Minister Abadi wants more military support from the international community in fighting Islamic State, a call he repeated at a news conference in Paris. He said he got promises from the coalition to help stem the flow of foreign fighters and finances to Islamic State. European Council on Foreign Relations Senior Policy Fellow Julian Barnes-Dacey agrees the campaign against Islamic State needs more military and political commitment and says there is also a key player missing, Iran.
Moving forward, it seems that there is going to have to be a greater and broader dialogue with Tehran if this is going to be any success, because without a political approach underpinning the military approach, it's hard to see a real solution to the crisis being found.
In Paris, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said the coalition was united and determined, but acknowledged the fight against Islamic State will take a long time. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The United States acknowledged Tuesday that senior U.S. officials met in Oman last week with representatives of the Houthi rebel movement that's overrun Yemen. The Wall Street Journal first reported Tuesday that Houthis held talks with Assistant Secretary of State Ann Patterson. The former ambassador traveled to Saudi Arabia and Oman in recent days in a bid to bring the multiple parties involved in Yemen's ongoing political crisis to negotiations. The meetings are the first publicly recognized talks between a U.S. official and Houthis since the rebels seized the Yemeni capital and ousted President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi earlier this year. Attempts by the United Nations to broker a deal between the internationally recognized but exiled president and the rebel group that controls Sana'a have repeatedly failed. Meanwhile, civilians in Yemen are facing misery, and the World Health Organization reports their situation is getting worse. VOA's Susan Yaki has more.
The World Health Organization says almost 2,000 people have been killed and 8,000 injured so far in the conflict in Yemen, with innocent civilians paying the highest price. Rana Sadani is the senior communications officer for the WHO regional office in Cairo, Egypt, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Rana.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the situation in Yemen?
The situation is really very worrying. Many people are losing their lives every day. We are very worried about the health system and the sustainability of the health system. The people who are suffering most are women and children, because there are more than 500,000 of displaced who were forced to flee the violence to neighboring governorate, and most of those displaced are women and children who need urgent care, especially those women who are pregnant and children who are malnourished.
What about the hospitals in Yemen? Are they overrun?
Hospitals around the country are closing down their emergency operations room and intensive care unit due to shortages in staff and fuel for generator. That's why WHO is working with partners to support all the health needs, especially through mobile clinic that can reach the people if there is a need. In addition to this, there are a huge shortage of medicine for diabetes, for hypertension, cancer. All of these medicines are no longer available. And we are noticing a spread of communicable diseases such as malaria and dengue fever, and we are very worried about outbreaks of polio and measles that are also a serious risk.
You mentioned the women and the children. What are they doing? How are they surviving?
Well, many of them live in public schools where you have hundreds of people living in overcrowded rooms, and they share one or two washroom per gender, which is really worrying, because this might increase the possibility of communicable diseases such as measles, for example.
What can be done?
Well, first of all, the health system need to continue functioning. The health staff need to be able to report to their work. And the medicines and the medical supplies need to be, we need to be able to dispatch these medicines and supplies to all affected governorate where they are needed most. And most importantly, all parties to the conflict need to respect the integrity of the health system. There are a lot of attacks against health premises, ambulances, medical personnel. All of this constitute a violation of the international humanitarian law. That's why the WHO called all the parties to the conflict to stop the attack against the health system and the personnel and vehicle in order to save the lives of innocent people.
So you're saying that they're actually targeting medical people who are trying to help others?
Yes, indeed, and many doctors and nurses lost their own lives when they were trying to help and save others.
Well, thank you, Rana, for speaking with us today and sharing this.
Thank you.
VOA Susan Yaki speaking with Rana Sidani of the World Health Organization. China is stepping up its efforts to curtail smoking. Beijing is imposing fines on those who decide to smoke outdoors. VOA's Ira Melman talks with Pam Redmond, based at Georgia State University's School of Public Health, who heads a project called the China Tobacco Control Project.
What we do is we partner with the cities, provide them technical support and a small amount of funding to establish comprehensive, effective, and sustainable tobacco control programs.
Pam, why China? People smoke elsewhere too, don't they?
We are asked that all the time. And China is truly the epicenter of the global tobacco epidemic. China grows more tobacco, they produce more cigarettes, and they have more smokers than any other country in the world. And to compare it to the U.S., there are more smokers in China than there are people in the U.S. There's over 300 million smokers today in China. So when you really think about it, you know, smoking is the single most preventable cause of death in the world. There are a lot of positive things happening, but there is so much more work to be done because there are still so many smokers there. There are still so many people that are exposed to secondhand smoke every day in the workplace and in the homes.
Now, you've just added a number of pretty large cities. People who don't know China don't know that some of the cities that are not the largest in China are larger than most cities around the rest of the world.
That's right.
So just go over that a little bit about who's being added, why, and when.
We are adding five new cities, and we're actually getting ready to launch this program, and all the mayors will be there in the city of Xi'an. Xi'an is one of our cities. Xiamen is another. Wuhan, Chengdu, and Chongqing. Just to mention Chongqing, that's 30 million people. So when you think about impact, the impact of smoke-free policies in public places in a city with 30 million people, that's huge. That has the potential for huge impact.
There was another question I had, and it dealt with where you guys are located in the state of Georgia. For people around the world, Georgia at least is on the southern end of what was the tobacco belt. Why are you guys located there?
That is true. why are we located here? I don't even know how to explain that. This is home. But you're right. We understand this firsthand. The ones of us working on this project, we've been working in tobacco control for a number of years. And when we think about China is where we were back in the 70s and the 80s in terms of smoking prevalence. It hasn't been that long ago that, you could smoke in public places here in the U.S., and men and women, were smoking, 40% of the population, over 40% of the population was smoking. It hasn't been that many years ago. But the thing with China is, they can't wait 40 years for this change because the public health impact is going to be too great.
Pam Redmond of Georgia State University's School of Public Health speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Still to come, a boy band singer goes it alone. Singer Nathan Sykes gained international fame with a boy band, The Wanted. Last year, the band members decided to take a break. But as VOA's David Byrd tells us, Sykes has a new solo project, and the first single comes out this month. Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's a look at what's happening in music. Last year, when the British boy band The Wanted announced that they were taking a break, singer Nathan Sykes was only 20 years old. But his passion for music didn't go away because he and his bandmates wanted a change. Sykes is launching his solo career with a new album, and the first single, Kiss Me Quick, comes out this month. The 22-year-old Gloucester, England native says that he could not imagine his life without music, so going solo was a natural next step.
I was 20 at the time when we decided it, and I was like, I'm far too young to stop doing what I love. And for anyone who's like, oh my God, he's left the band, he's like, well, what do you expect me to do with my life? Sit in a dark room for the next 10 years and wait for a phone call to say, oh, we're going to do another tour? It's like, what do you expect me to do? Do you know what I mean? So I was like, I love music so much, and I can't imagine my life without music. So I just went and made a solo record.
Sykes says that fans can look for his new album to be a departure from some of The Wanted's hits like Glad You Came or Chasing the Sun.
It's like soulful pop. And there's like a nice, healthy balance between fun, light-hearted, kind of flirty, upbeat, like kind of horn-influenced tracks, and that kind of contrasts well with the deeper kind of like soul of the album.
For the new album,
Nathan Sykes worked with producers and songwriters Harmony Samuels, Babyface, and Diane Warren to craft his sound. Nathan Sykes says that even his former bandmates in The Wanted liked the new sound, though they weren't above giving him a little ribbing about it.
They were like, wow, this is like a lot better than I thought it would be. I was like, that's a backhanded compliment. But I was like, what, did you not think I was capable of that? They were like, no, if I'm honest. I was like, oh, great, cheers, guys. But, yeah, they're pleasantly surprised.
The full album is scheduled for release in the autumn in the UK and North America. And Nathan Sykes said he is always open to doing another album with The Wanted should he his bandmates decide they want to.
Obviously, I'm so focused on this at the moment and excited by it. But, of course, the door's always open to doing something in the future, maybe with the boys.
For VOA's International Edition, I'm David Berg.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can stop, look, and listen on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, Chief Executive Officer Dana Hyde and Deputy Vice President Fatima Sumar met with Mongolian leaders to discuss development of the country's new compact and impacts and sustainability from the country's first compact. The discussions focused on MCC's approach to reduce poverty through economic growth, the Mongolian government's leadership role in developing a second compact, and the constraints analysis, a key foundation of compact development. The MCC delegation also congratulated the Mongolian government on the 25th anniversary of its democratic transition and reaffirmed the strong relationship between the United States and Mongolia. Both Mongolia and the United States agreed that the anniversary marks an occasion for continued cooperation between the two countries, as well as MCC's commitment to helping Mongolia consolidate its democratic transition by supporting its economic development. Throughout their week-long visit to Mongolia, the delegation visited projects from the first compact, including the Salkit Wind Farms, a vocational school in Qair, peri-urban rangeland areas in Tuv Amag, the Qair-Sainshand Road, and Hospital No. 3. They met with local government officials in Gobisamber and Umnogobi Amags and a wide range of civil society representatives, including women leaders. The delegation concluded its visit with a visit to Ulaanbaatar's Gur district and meeting with the mayor. In December 2014, the MCC Board of Directors selected Mongolia for the development of a second compact. Currently, MCC and Mongolian officials are conducting an analysis of the country's economy and constraints to growth. The Millennium Challenge Corporation is proud to work with Mongolia to sustain the gains it has made towards economic empowerment for all the people of Mongolia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
faithful.